and his socialist brethren to be blasphemy, the liberalism of the 30s was heresy. But he also saw the effectiveness of the labels in wrecking opponents' reputations. He branded with those labels not only opponents whom he may sincerely have believed, no matter how mistakenly, to be communists, but also opponents he was well aware were not communists and had never been, men like Gentle Stanley Isaacs, the Republican reformer who became Manhattan Borough President in 1937, whom Moses had known for 20 years, and whose only crime was that he had once been ill-advised enough to appoint brilliant young Simon Gerson to a minor position on his staff without bothering to investigate him and learn that he was an avowed communist. He branded with the labels young city officials whose dossiers, compiled by his bloodhounds, clearly revealed that while they may once, years before, have belonged to communist front organizations, they had long since renounced their membership in those organizations. In applying the labels to them, he simply never bothered to mention the renunciation. If Robert Moses was a pioneer in the fields of parks and highways, he was also a pioneer in McCarthyism, 20 years before McCarthy. And his estimate of the effectiveness of his new weapon was not an overestimation. Not even the deep affection of a strong-minded and independent mayor for a young man he seemed to regard almost as a son could stand before it. The young man, tall, handsome, and brilliant, was Paul J. Kern, LaGuardia's law secretary, and, of all his youthful aides, perhaps the one closest to the mayor, his companion on his Sunday tours of the city, and so frequent a guest at his apartment that he seemed almost a member of the family. Ironically, Kern admired Moses. "I was a Moses fanatic," he was to recall ruefully. But when, early in 1936, LaGuardia appointed him, at the age of 27, to the Municipal Civil Service Commission, he refused, as young, brilliant Robert Moses would have refused during his days with the Municipal Civil Service Commission, to allow the older, changed Robert Moses to continue circumventing civil service regulations by firing Park Department employees on whim and paying favorites two salaries at once. And he insisted that employees of Moses' public authorities be brought under civil service regulations. First, Moses destroyed the source of Kern's power, his friendship with the mayor. He did so, Kern charges, with a tactic that would have been familiar to Ansley Wilcox and Judge Clearwater, who felt Moses had used it to discredit them with Al Smith. "He lied," Kern says. "He lied about me to LaGuardia." There was, Kern says, a whole series of lies that gradually poisoned his friendship with the mayor. Once, for example, Moses told LaGuardia that Kern had disobeyed LaGuardia's specific order to certify a disputed civil service list of authority employees, although Kern had in fact done so, and LaGuardia, without bothering to check the facts, flew into a towering rage and wrote Kern a letter that stung him deeply. Years later, Kern could recall even the salutation, "My dear Mr. Kern." "He had never called me Mr. Kern before," he would say. Proud and angry and hurt, "It was almost like his father disowning him," said Professor Wallace Sayre, a Civil Service Commission member at the time, Kern would not attempt to explain. And months later, just as the rift between the two men was beginning to heal, Moses widened it beyond any possibility of healing, with a public smear that made Kern a political liability that the mayor could not afford to keep in his administration. The commission, with Kern reinforced by the appointment of Dr. Frank A. Schaefer, a Fordham University Latin professor he had persuaded to take a leave of absence to accept the post of commission secretary, the same post to which Dr. Robert Moses had once aspired, began in 1939 to press harder and harder for complete civil service reform, the same type of reform for which Dr. Moses had once pressed, and to enforce it suggested encouraging city employees to report venality and civil service violations by awarding promotion credits for verifiable tips. Terming the commission's actions un-American, Moses suggested that Dr. Schaefer send this communication to the OGPU, secret police in Russia, whose American representative you seem to be. And when Kern defended Schaefer, He was a good Roman Catholic, and being called a communist upset him tremendously. We doubt very much if you would recruit OGPU agents at Fordham. Moses called Kern an OGPU agent. Kern was vulnerable to such attack. Addicted to overenthusiasm in his liberalism, he wryly describes himself as a sucker for causes. Years before, while still in his teens, he had joined a number of organizations that later turned out to be communist fronts. And though by 1939 he had seen through them and resigned in disgust, Moses' attacks on him as a communist were echoed by the red and Jew-baiting Detroit demagogue Father Coughlin, who revealed that Kern's insistence on reforming the police department's promotion system was really a plot to place over the cops of New York, 90% of them good Christians, a group of Reds, an OGPU, and who could not tell a nightstick from a streak of salami. The Hearst papers were soon yowling for the young man's scalp, and a committee of the Tammany-dominated city council began investigating the commission. Kern believes that Moses inspired and helped direct from behind the scenes not only the investigation, one of the viler chapters in New York political history. The committee took advantage of the association in the public mind of godless communism with free love to drag into the hearing insinuations about Kern's love life, but also the public smear campaign against him of which the investigation was the centerpiece, and that the park commissioner's bloodhounds kept the investigators supplied with fresh ammunition. This belief was concurred in by Wendells and at least one other key LaGuardia official, who points out that new revelations about Kern's background were generally aired first by Murray Davis, the World Telegram's senior political writer, who had been used before, and would be used again, by Moses, to get before the public facts Moses wanted the public to know, without letting it know that the facts came from him. And if there is no evidence to document Moses' continued participation in the public smear campaign against Kern, the key investigators are all dead, and Davis, who later became Moses' personal public relations man, isn't talking, there is plenty of evidence to document his continued participation in a private campaign, a campaign to make LaGuardia suspect his young friend. Moses reminded the mayor continually of Kern's communist leanings. Once, for example, he wrote him a personal letter that concluded, "Don't let Kern try to set up an OGPU in New York." The tactic worked with a mayor who was constantly terrified that his liberal administration would be tarred as communist, a charge he felt would alienate irreparably the city's huge block of Catholic voters. In 1941, despite his respect for Stanley Isaacs, the mayor dumped the reformer from his ticket because of the outcry, which Moses kept alive, over Isaacs' hiring of the young communist Gerson. By the end of the investigation, he was hardly speaking to Kern, and not long thereafter, in the midst of another dispute, he fired him. Kern says he understood why Moses wanted him fired. His hatred of me was not based on the fact that he thought I was a communist, I'm sure he didn't, but that I represented interference with the way he wanted to run the park department, he says. And from that standpoint, Moses' tactics were wholly successful. Until the end of his park commissionership in 1960, no civil service commissioner ever interfered with the department again. Moses' fellow commissioners, anxious for a fairer share of WPA funds or a more equitable relationship between their departments and his, might have slowed him down, but he didn't let them. Moses' normal technique with other commissioners was to bully them. Often this approach worked, for they were well aware that if they attempted to challenge him, he would be attacked by the press and by their mutual boss, the mayor. One commissioner with whom this approach did not work, of course, was Wendells. "Paul knew how to handle him all right," says William C. Chandler, Wendells' chief assistant, and in 1938 his successor as corporation counsel. "We'd been in office about 6 weeks, and Paul went up to Albany and left me in charge of the office, and while he was up there, Moses called me on the phone. He said he was being held up because we were working too slow on condemnation proceedings in which he was interested. He was really yelling at me. He got ruder and ruder about our not getting his title cleared. You didn't get this done. You didn't get that done. You haven't got the certiorari. What the hell's the matter with you? I told him we had only been in office 6 weeks. He said, God damn it, I got my office organized in 48 hours. If you fellows don't get going, I'm going to call up the press and tell them what a bunch of incompetents you are. I called up Paul Windels in Albany, and he said, I'll tell you what you do. There are a lot of cases in which we're being held up by something we need from the park department. You get a list of those cases, and you have it right on your desk. When Moses calls up the next time, don't take any abuse from him. Just say exactly this. Listen here, Moses, God damn it. What the hell's the matter with your office? We've got this and this, and you're holding us up. Well, he did call up again, and he started being rude, and I said even more than Windels had told me to. I said, and if you ever come over here, I'll kick your ass out of the office. Well, as soon as I did that, his whole tone of voice changed. He said, well, perhaps. His whole tone of voice changed. He said, well, perhaps you and I'd better talk this over. How about coming over for lunch? I went over, and the door was opened by the most charming, gracious, smiling man. He gave me a very sumptuous lunch. I think we had a bottle of wine. I don't remember. And he said, oh, we're going to get on fine. A short time later, he called up again on something he was mad about and started to yell again. But by this time, I knew how to handle him. I yelled back, and immediately it was, oh, all right, oh, all right, and he calmed down. The lesson wasn't lost on Chandler. If you stood right up to him, he backed right down, he says. He was just a natural bully, so whenever he tried something, I'd pretend to lose my temper. And after a while, he didn't try anymore. But the other commissioners didn't know Moses as well as Windels, and they didn't have the benefit of his advice, and when Moses' harsh voice rasped over the telephone into their offices, threatening to take them to the press and the mayor, they thought the only way to avoid such a fate was to do what he wanted. Many of the other commissioners despised and resented Moses. When they attempted to establish an esprit by meeting for weekly commissioners' lunches, Moses refused to attend, a gesture that they interpreted correctly as an attempt by Moses to show them that he considered himself above them. They considered the plant from a park department greenhouse that Moses sent in his place each week a gratuitous insult. But while they might despise and resent Moses, they also feared him, and they generally did what he wanted. Even the more independent among them, moreover, were outwitted by his brilliance in the bureaucratic arts. Pointing out to a recalcitrant commissioner that because of the park department's unprecedented activity, its demands on the commissioner's own department were undoubtedly disrupting its normal procedures, Moses would suggest that the commissioner designate one of his aides to do nothing but handle park department liaison, perhaps even allowing him to work in the arsenal. Then Moses, by bullying or by charm, would take the aide into camp, make him an ally of the park department, and thereby practically freeing himself of the necessity of winning the other department's approval of his actions. Soon, Moses had his own man in the office of many other commissioners, men loyal to him rather than to their own commissioners, and useful to Moses not only as liaison with other departments, but as spies within their ranks. The city's elected officials, motivated by 100 political considerations, might have slowed his building, but he didn't let them. The broad powers possessed by the Board of Estimate, the upper house of the city's bicameral legislature, would normally have made ignoring it impossible. But many of those powers rested on the power of the purse, and the purse that was financing most of Moses' projects was not the board's, but the federal government's. And the power that remained to the board he offset with the techniques, stake-driving, whip-sawing, wedge-driving, deception, that he had learned and mastered during a decade of building public works on Long Island. Because the charter gave the board authority over all street closings, and Moses wanted to build Christie Forsyth Park across 4 Lower East Side streets, he submitted his plans for the street closings to the board for approval. Manhattan Borough President Levy noted that crosstown traffic would be crammed into the two streets Moses was willing to leave open through the park, Grand and Delancey. Although Moses said those two streets were adequate to handle the traffic, board members said it would overcrowd them and refused to approve the street closings without further discussion and a full-scale on-site inspection. But when they arrived at the site a few days later, they found the streets already closed, with concrete hastily laid during those few days by Moses workers, in which the footings of fences, benches, swings, seesaws, and even handball courts were rapidly hardening into immovable reality. When board approval of a project was absolutely essential because he needed city funds to acquire the site, say, he would whipsaw it by stating that the WPA had agreed to finance the project and urging them to grab the money while it was available. At the same time, he would be assuring the WPA that city approval was assured and the land was therefore available, an argument that persuaded the WPA, anxious for fast results, to give its approval. If they did, he would say, the city would get the improvement and desperately needed jobs without any city expenditure. If the board said it wanted time to study the project, Moses would tell them that the delay would cost the city the WPA funds. And this argument, backed by the threat, which was frequently implemented, to tell the press about the threatened loss, was one which almost invariably brought the board to its knees. He drove wedges, too. In his 1935 budget request, he asked the board to allocate $3,600,000 for construction projects in Jacob Riis, Fort Tryon, Pelham Bay, and the two marine parks. The board did, and the thin edge of the wedge was in. Year after year, thereafter, he returned to the board for new allocations, which he said were necessary to make the improvements built with the previous allocations usable. Unless the money was given, he would say, the previous allocations would be wasted. Jacob Riis Park would be completed by 1938, after an additional city allocation of $3,500,000, but the others were not. Year after year, the board would allocate new funds, and then would learn that still more were needed. Marine Park in Brooklyn could be completed for $6 million, he assured the board. When $6 million had been spent on the park, Moses informed the board that an additional $6 million would be necessary, and when that was spent, the park would still be far from completed. He deceived the board constantly. To obtain permission to construct a stadium on Randall's Island, he had assured the board that the PWA project would cost the city not a penny. Then, with permission obtained and work underway, he announced that he would need $250,000 additional for materials the WPA would not buy, but assured the board that this was the only contribution the city would have to make for the whole Triborough Bridge project, in return for which the federal government was making a contribution of $46,200,000. The board allocated the money. Within a month, he was back again, asking for a special bond issue of $8 million to pay for the right-of-way for the bridge approaches. He blandly told the board that when he had spoken of the whole Triborough Bridge project, he naturally hadn't meant the land for the project. He hardly bothered to conceal the technique. One of his press releases on the Central Park Zoo contained two different estimates of the cost, but because the board had left itself open to political blackmail by approving earlier fund requests without adequately checking them, it was helpless to deny him later requests and thereby allow him to charge that it had wasted the public's money by building only part of a project. Moreover, since the board's membership was continually changing, just as one borough president or comptroller learned never to trust Moses' figures, he would lose an election, and the man who took over his seat would have to begin the learning process anew. And most important, while the board may have distrusted Moses' figures, its lack of adequate engineering assistance prevented it from coming up with any of its own. Those on the board who tried to bring him to heel soon wished they hadn't. When they dueled with him, they did so from the dignity of their seats behind the massive raised mahogany horseshoe in the board chamber, backed by fluted Corinthian columns and wine-red draperies. But their setting couldn't save them from his tongue. He would enter the chamber hearty, very hearty, with this broad grin, recalls McGoldrick, who, as comptroller, sat in one of the seats on the horseshoe. He was very impressive, tall, handsome, and he'd always come in with a team of his aides behind him, a different team for each project, and he knew his stuff inside and out. He wasn't like some of the other commissioners, who had aides with them, and every time you asked them a question, they had to turn to them and whisper to get the answer. And this was very impressive. His men didn't seem to have any purpose there, except that one or two always stood behind him to hand him papers when he needed them. When the matter in which he was interested was called, he would walk to the railing at which officials stood to address the board. There was no public address system or microphone then, with the same grin. He was very breezy and self-confident. I remember his coming up very genially, with his head thrown back and a grin on his face. But let one of the board members venture to criticize, or even to question, one of his projects, and the grin could fade in an instant. He was very intolerant of any criticism of anything he wanted to do, McGoldrick recalls. He wanted to do it, he was going to do it, and withering with his adjectives anyone who opposed him. Says one observer, when someone else was speaking, he'd begin to pace up and down. He'd turn his back, total boredom, off to one side a little. Then he'd suddenly whip around without asking permission, walk up and make some sharp remark, often out of the side of his mouth, you know, throwing his shoulders around. There was no indication of respect. He seemed to emanate an air of arrogance, of contempt, for the men sitting up there. If he felt called upon to make extended reply, he would do so while rocking slightly on his heels, his large head thrown back and to one side, and the words that rasped out of the handsome, sensual mouth were devastating. Time and again, said one magazine writer, he transfixes his opponent with graceful malice. As for the Board of Aldermen and its successor under the new charter, the City Council, he treated those worthies, many of whom he told Lazarus he could buy with a couple of jobs, like men who could be bought with a couple of jobs. Or he simply ignored them. In 1939, he urged the Park Department's 3,000 employees to vote against councilmen who had slashed the department's budget requests, and when the council, after hearing a committee report calling Moses' action one of the most brazen attempts at political intimidation in the history of the city, ordered him to appear before it to explain the action, he simply didn't bother to show up, sending a letter saying he hadn't received adequate notice. The complexities of life in a city might have slowed him down, but he didn't let them. There was a difference between building parks and parkways in the country, on sparsely populated Long Island, where most of Moses' previous projects had been concentrated, or in rural upstate counties, and building them in a city. And the difference was people. When you built a park on a deserted sandbar, such as Jones Beach, you didn't have to worry about removing people from the site and relocating them somewhere else, because there weren't any people. You were building parks and parkways for people, of course, and therefore you had to take people's needs into consideration in planning them, but only in a broad, impersonal sense, for you were planning for people in the tens of thousands, humanity in the mass, and the needs of humanity in the mass could be deduced as well from a general knowledge of people as from a specific knowledge of the human beings who made up the mass. When you built public works in a countryside, you were painting on a clean and empty canvas, and you could use brushstrokes as broad as you chose. If there was a formula for building public works, for getting things done on Long Island, it was not a simple one. No formula that had to include cooperation with as powerful an oligarchy as the North Shore robber barons, as greedy a political machine as the Nassau County GOP, and as short-sighted a collection of public officials as the New York State Legislature could be simple. But many factors that would have made the formula vastly more complicated did not have to be included in it. Moses could determine by himself, by his own unaided foresight and insight, his strictly private conception of the public need, what types of projects were needed, where they should be located, and how they should be designed. Things were different in the city. The crucial factor in the building of public works on Long Island was space, vast, endless tracts of uncluttered openness. In the city, the crucial factor was lack of space, and the fact that space was not merely filled, but filled with people. People with their endlessly intertwined, hopelessly snarled tangles of aspirations and antagonisms, hopes and fears, dreams and dreads. People on the site would have to be removed, evicted, dispossessed, thrown out, relocated, and removal would rend the fabric of their lives. The lives of those near the site might not be rent, but they would certainly be altered, for the physical environment which did so much to shape their daily existence would be altered, not only in dramatic ways, such as the raising of a block of tenements for a bridge anchorage, but in ways subtle and endlessly various. The construction of almost any public work inevitably added to or subtracted from that delicate balance of humanity that was a city neighborhood, ingredients that would change that balance forever, change the neighborhood's economic or ethnic composition, make it quieter or noisier, cleaner or dirtier, cut one part of it off from the rest, fill it with new life or drain it of its vitality, turn it into something different, possibly better but also possibly worse, than it was before. Therefore, unlike a public work on Long Island, a public work in the city had to be planned not only in terms of itself, but in terms of its environment, the neighborhood in which it was located. It had to be judged not only in physical terms, highway as highway, park as park, but also in social terms, in terms of its effect on the human beings who had to live around it. If in creating public works on Long Island, one could paint on a clean and empty canvas, in creating public works in New York City, one had to paint over an already existing mural, a mural whose brushstrokes were tiny and intricate, and often, when one looked closely, quite wonderful, lending to the vast urban panorama subtle shadings and delicate tints and an endless variety, so that if it was crowded and confused and ugly, it was also full of life and very human, so much so, in fact, that while the painting as a whole might lack beauty, order, balance, perspective, a unifying principle, and an overall effect commensurate with its size, it nonetheless possessed many charming little touches and an overall vitality, a brio, that made it unique and should not be lost. If Moses attempted to employ on the canvas of New York City the same broad brushstrokes that he had used on the canvas of Long Island, he would be obliterating the city's intricacies indiscriminately instead of working around those that were worth keeping and preserving them. And while this method might result in the creation of something beautiful and good, adding to the mural new values, it would also almost certainly destroy many existing values. A public work in the city might, in terms of itself, Moses' terms, be an excellent public work, while in broader terms being a poor public work. A highway, for example, that, however magnificently designed, was damaging either to the adjacent neighborhood, shattering its essential unity, cutting its homes off from its playground or from its churches and shopping areas, filling its quiet residential areas with noise and gasoline fumes that made them no longer nice places to live and to bring up children, or to the city as a whole. A highway, for example, through a hitherto sparsely inhabited area that initiated a sudden influx of subdivisions and apartment houses, loading it with people before the city had provided the sewers and subways and schools those people needed, and that by boosting land costs made it immensely difficult for a financially hard-pressed city to provide such services, services which could, if installed before the highway was built, have been installed at a price within the city's means. If one tried to plan public works in New York City by the same simplistic formula by which the public works of Long Island had been planned, the public works thus created might well destroy what was good in New York, even while it was supposed to be improving the city. Part of Moses' Long Island formula, the vision and the viciousness, the imagination and the ruthlessness, the drive, the urgent, savage thrust, the instinct for the magnificent and the jugular that overrode purely selfish opposition, short-sightedness, and red tape to turn vision into reality, was needed in the city, needed desperately, For without it, the city would never be able to build parks and roads and bridges, or for that matter, housing or hospitals, sewers or schools, on the scale its citizens needed. But Moses' formula could be successful in the city only as the basis of a new, vastly more complicated and subtle and sophisticated formula, one that would turn public works into a far truer reflection of the subtle and complicated human needs they had to serve in the city. A whole new input, a factor of humanity, would have to be added. And Moses would not allow it to be added. Moses had a genius for grasping the needs of people in the mass, of people in the tens and hundreds of thousands, of a city and a state as a whole, and for devising ways to meet those needs. But that genius could not help him grasp the needs of a specific city neighborhood in which he was building a small park or playground, for those needs might be shared by no other neighborhood in the world. In the first place, the people in the mass that he understood were people of a particular social strata that his own background enabled him to understand, the classes he called upper and comfortable middle. He had never had any interest in, and therefore had little understanding of, classes he considered beneath his own, the classes who made up so many of New York City's neighborhoods. Moreover, even a genius couldn't deduce the needs of a neighborhood, any neighborhood, until he knew and understood it. And the only way of knowing and understanding it was to study and learn about it, to find out how many children lived in it and how old they were, what games they liked to play, what games their parents liked to play with them on weekends, what games their parents liked to play among themselves, to find out whether the parents liked to play games at all or simply to sit quietly and talk, whether the neighborhood's teenage boys wanted a place to walk after dinner and watch the neighborhood's teenage girls walk, or whether they wanted to spend their time after dinner playing basketball, to find out which streets the neighborhood's mothers considered safe enough so that their children could cross them alone and thus use a playground on the far side whenever they wanted, and which streets the mothers considered too dangerous, to find out exactly how far the children were willing to walk to get to a playground in the first place. And there was only one way to learn about a neighborhood: listen to its people, discuss their problems with them. Unless Moses did that, not Moses himself necessarily, his lieutenants or the architect designing the specific playground in question, he simply wouldn't, couldn't know enough about the neighborhood to satisfy its needs. On a broader scale, that was also the only way to study and learn how to plan larger public works for New York City. It was the only way to plan even those large parks, Central, Prospect, Van Cortlandt, Casina, Alley Pond, that contained plenty of space in which there lived no people at all. Even these parks could not be developed successfully by a formula as simplistic as that on which the Long Island parks had been developed. For these parks were not just open space, but open space within a city in which open space was becoming terribly scarce, and the space within them was therefore precious and must be utilized not just to advantage, but to fullest advantage. And what was that advantage? What was it most important for those big parks to give the city? The city's facilities for active recreation were laughably inadequate. Therefore, the park must provide them. They must be filled with baseball diamonds and football fields, tennis and handball and basketball courts, skating rinks and swimming pools. But the city was also growing, growing and spreading. In 1934, most of Staten Island, the entire central portion of Queens, and much of southern Brooklyn were still free of intensive development. But real estate developers were already eyeing those areas too. Open space, quiet open space, natural settings in which city dwellers could find relief from gray concrete and congestion and noise, was precious in New York now. Parks must provide that, too. If they did not, there would soon be no place within the great city in which these values could be found. It was particularly vital that these values be preserved within the city, because Moses' restrictive policies had made it difficult for the city's poor, who did not have access to private automobiles, to reach his Long Island parks. If these values were not preserved in the city's own parks, there would soon be no place at all in which a poor family could find them. The city's parks had to serve both recreational and conservational functions, but designing the parks so that they could provide both functions would be immensely difficult, for the two functions were not compatible. Peace and quiet and solitude were in general obtainable only at a far remove from the shouts and frantic activity of the playing field. And while parks like Cascina and Queens were considered large, Cascina contained exactly 219 acres. 219 acres sounded big, but it sounded a lot smaller when one realized that a single baseball diamond took up 2.5 acres, and even a small parking field, 25. There was room in parks like Cascina either for peace or for parking fields, but not for both. With the exception of the two marine parks, which were not really parks at all, but only undeveloped marshland, the only park of 1,000 acres in the whole city was Van Cortlandt, and even in Van Cortlandt you could have both active play facilities and natural peaceful areas only if you exercised the greatest ingenuity and delicacy in laying them out. Therefore, choices had to be made, hard choices, and they could not be made intelligently without determining, in the case of each park, whether it was going to serve the neighborhood around it or the city as a whole, and which functions were most needed in that park by the people it was going to serve. There had been so much space on the island that there had been no need to ask such questions in planning parks. Even after Moses had built all the baseball diamonds and tennis courts and bathhouses and parking fields that he wanted in Heckscher State Park, for example, more than 1,200 of the park's 1,657 acres remained in their natural wooded state, enough for green, quiet woods away from crowds. Moses himself had been uninterested in a park's natural functions. His mind saw people in the mass, running, jumping, swinging tennis rackets or baseball bats. One reason he wanted Triborough Stadium so big was that he wanted it large enough for mass calisthenics on the Third Reich scale. His vision never focused on the individual wandering alone through a forest or on the family sprawling in solitude in a meadow. In thinking of parks, he did not, except incidentally, think of them as places of forests or meadows or solitude. And if the very breadth of his vision thus made it hard for him to think of parks as untouched nature, so did the very force of his creativity. He was a builder, a molder, a man who yearns to put his hand to and reshape, improve, whatever he sees. Therefore, to him, a park was not open space. The open space was already there. The park was that portion of the open space that he had filled with his own creations. He referred to the portions of the Long Island parks without active play facilities as undeveloped for park use. His lack of interest in untouched nature had not mattered on Long Island, but it was to matter greatly in New York. And how small could a park be? What was the smallest number of square feet it was feasible to supervise and maintain as a public place of recreation? 5 acres, the area of a standard city block? 3 acres? 2? 1? The 100 by 20 feet that was the size of the standard building lot in tenement sections, and that was often the only piece of vacant land anywhere around? This was a question of desperate importance. The recreational needs of city families that couldn't afford to own a car, and those families comprised a full 2/3 of the city's population, had to be satisfied within their immediate neighborhoods. And because it was too expensive to condemn buildings in these neighborhoods, and the only land still vacant was small plots, the only parks that could be built in these neighborhoods were small parks. But even small plots were enormously expensive to maintain and supervise, far more expensive per square foot than large parks. Given the hard fact that the city would never be able to create nearly enough parks for its people, was there any sense in developing a large number of small parks? Where did you sink those resources that were available, into large parks that could be developed relatively economically, or into small parks that alone could provide recreation for that portion of the city's people that most needed recreation? The needs of providing recreation for the city's poor must be weighed against the cost of that provision. What a later generation would come to call priorities must be established, and it would not be easy to establish them. The hard choices would have to be made. Only by the most intense analysis and discussion with the people most directly involved, the city's poor, could these choices be made intelligently. And again, because the success of a neighborhood park depended so largely on intimate knowledge of that neighborhood, once the decision to establish a park in a neighborhood was taken, even more intense discussion with the residents of that neighborhood would be necessary. Then there was the question of roads in parks. Should there even be roads in parks? And if so, where within the parks should they be located? Once, in the days, a decade or even 2 decades before, in which the young Robert Moses had been planning parks and roads, the answer to that question had been quite clear. Driving in automobiles had then still been thought of primarily as pleasure, a pursuit of comfortable middle-class or wealthy fathers, the only fathers who could afford automobiles, taking their families for an outing, just as driving horse-drawn carriages had been a pursuit for pleasure. And it had therefore been important to ensure that these families had the most pleasant surroundings possible to drive through, and within the city's limits, the most pleasant surroundings were those provided by parks. The provision of pleasant scenery for drivers to enjoy was, in fact, a primary function of parks. That was why every great city in Europe had its great driving park. Paris, its Bois de Boulogne, Rome, its Pincian Hill, Florence, its Cascine, and London, its Hyde Park. Roads had belonged in parks in the 19th century, so much so that, if necessary, other values of a park had to be sacrificed to provide the roads with the best of the park's scenery. But this was the 20th century now, and the answer to the question, do roads belong in parks, was no longer clear, for the nature of driving had largely changed. The automobile age, still in its infancy when Robert Moses had stood on Riverside Drive and planned his great highway going uptown along the water in 1914, still only in its adolescence when Moses had been planning his Long Island parkways in 1924, had come to full maturity by the time he came to power in New York City in 1934. There had been 273,435 motor vehicles in New York City in 1924. There were 804,620 now. And people no longer used their cars primarily for weekend pleasure trips, but, increasingly, to get to and from work and to shop. Cars were part of people's daily lives, and they drove faster now. They had less time for scenery. What implications did these facts have for parkways? What was a parkway, anyway? Was it still mainly a source of beauty and pleasure, or had it changed into a source of convenience, or at least intended convenience? Were people still interested in parkways primarily because of the scenery they could see along them, or were they interested in them primarily as a means of getting from one place to another? And if the latter, what was the significance of that fact? Should the best of scenery still be reserved for the driver? But Robert Moses wouldn't allow any discussion. He wouldn't allow discussion because discussion would have slowed down his building programs, and he felt that he couldn't allow them to be slowed down. And he wouldn't allow discussion because he had no respect for the opinions of the public that he would have had to admit to the discussions. And even if he limited discussion to the experts who were interested in the various fields, he had no respect for their opinions either. Robert Moses had no respect for anyone's opinion but his own. Once, Moses had at least listened to his own aides, allowed them to argue with him, tested his opinions against theirs. But now that had changed, too. In the first days of his power, he had hired aides whose opinions were worth listening to. He had selected men for ability, engineering ability, legal ability. The aides he was hiring now had also to possess an additional ability, the ability to say, yes, sir. Lunches at Moses' office were really starting to get pretty sickening, recalls one top LaGuardia official. Even if he only had one guest, he would always have 6 or 8 of his Moses men, my muchachos, he used to call them, at the table, and it was all, yes, sir, R.M., no, sir, R.M., right as usual, R.M. When he laughed, they laughed, only louder. You know what I mean. Christ, when he made a statement, you could look around the table and see 8 heads nodding practically in unison. It was like a goddamned Greek chorus. Reuben Lazarus, invited by Moses to become chief counsel for the Triborough Bridge Authority, refused. I didn't want to be a doormat for any man. And when Moses asked him to recommend one of his assistants, Lazarus selected the one who, he had noticed, doesn't answer back. And in the taxi taking William Liebwohl to lunch with Moses, told him what was going to be expected of him. You're going to have to be able to bend over and take a kick in the ass and say, thank you, sir, with a smile. At that luncheon, Lazarus recalls, Liebwohl did not answer back. Moses hired him and kept him on as Triborough Council for more than 30 years. The effect of such a hiring policy was predictable. The aides he had hired in the 1920s, the Art Howlands, Sid Shapiros, Bill Lathams, Bill Chapins, and George Spargos, became legendary throughout state and city government for their ability, drive, and indefatigability. The aides he hired in the 1930s were quite another story. The older guys, tops, says William Zeckendorf, who had a keen eye for men himself. But some of the others he had working for him, I wouldn't have hired them to sweep my lobbies. Moses' sensitivity to criticism had impressed itself on such men. They didn't criticize anything he said. They saw he was less than receptive to suggestions, and they didn't make suggestions. If Moses refused to accept ideas from public, experts, or aides, from, in general, anyone at all, the source of his ideas, his concept of public works for New York City, could be only his own mind. The mind was brilliant, but even a brilliant mind is only as good as the material, the input, fed into it. It was at about this time that Lazarus, planning to write a book about government and public figures, and keeping a card file of impressions, wrote on a card he filed under the name Robert Moses, Bob Moses has climbed so high on his own ego, has become so hidebound in his own arbitrariness, that he has removed himself almost entirely from reality and has insulated himself within his own individuality. This difficulty could to some degree have been overcome by sheer mental ability. Robert Moses' mind was supple, resourceful. Even without input of social and human considerations, it could have deduced some of these considerations simply by thinking about the problems involved. But Robert Moses no longer had much time to think. Building a state park system had been an immense job, but he had brought to it not only immense energy, but immense ability to discipline that energy. He had found time, made time to be more precise, made it by devoting to his work the hours when other men play or relax or sleep or lunch, made it by working 14, 16, 18, 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. He had found time to oversee every detail of design, to present his architects and engineers with the basic concepts he wanted followed, to insist during the fleshing out of those concepts on a standard of excellence, of boldness and daring far above that common for public works, and to inspire the architects and engineers, I know you can do drawbridges, can you do beautiful drawbridges, to raise their work to that standard. And besides furnishing inspiration, he furnished ideas. Many of the most brilliant touches at Jones Beach had been his ideas. He had found time, made time, to infuse the brick and concrete and sandstone of that park and of other Long Island parks from Valley Stream to Montauk and of other state parks from Palisades to Niagara with his personal genius. But when Moses expanded his sphere of activity into New York City, he did not stop his work on Long Island or in the rest of the state. In 1934, on Long Island alone, he built Bethpage State Park and Bethpage State Parkway. In 1935, he built the Meadowbrook Causeway. In 1936, he built great new bathhouses at Sunken Meadow and Heckscher State Parks, as well as the Heckscher State Parkway Spur. And during all these years, he was extending the northern and southern state parkways and building literally scores of smaller park structures. Instead, he simply added to his state park work, itself enough to tax the strength of even the strongest of men, work in the city that was not limited to the direction of 80,000 men in the rebuilding of a huge park system, but that also included the building of 4 parkways and 3 bridges, with each of the bridge-building jobs in itself a job that would have been considered a full-time job for any other man. It was not possible for him to make for himself any more time than he had already made. There were no more days in a week than 7, or weeks in a year than 52, and he was working all those days and weeks already. He had already sloughed off all social life and most family life. There was nothing more in his life that could be sloughed off. He was already, with his use of his limousine as an office and conference room, making use of every available minute. There were no more minutes to be found unless he drove himself beyond the limit of his physical and mental and emotional strength. And the almost nervous breakdown of December 1934 had shown how close he was crowding that limit. It was lack of time, more than any other single reason, that accounted for an astonishing fact about many New York City park projects. They were banal. Richard Spencer Childs recalls visiting Moses at his office one day and having their conversation interrupted by the arrival of Amar Embry. "Embry had a bunch of drawings of some buildings for the parks," Childs recalls. "He had brought them to show Moses. Moses went right through them. Nope, okay, nope, throwing them to one side or the other, if he approved them or not. There were no hard feelings. Moses and Embry were good friends. There was lots of respect between them. But here, perhaps $100,000 worth of public business was settled on Moses' offhand taste." And, recalls Childs, "when Moses finished with the drawings, Embry pointed to one he had rejected and said, 'That one you threw away was the best of the lot.'" Embry may well have been correct. The offhand taste, even of a genius, is offhand taste. Working incredibly fast, Moses had managed to make the Long Island projects public works of genius. Now he was trying to work even faster, and he was working too fast to do even a good job. When there is no time for the thinking required for original creation, the tendency is to repeat what has proven successful in the past. Many of Moses' New York projects, not all, those in which he was particularly interested and on which he spent substantial time would be magnificent additions to the civic estate, began to reveal a conscious effort to duplicate aspects of his acclaimed Long Island parks. In this tendency lies the explanation for the otherwise inexplicable failure to make provision for baby carriages at so many New York parks. No provision for baby carriages had been necessary at the entrances to the Long Island parks because people got to them by automobiles. If there was a difference that should have been obvious to Moses, that the parks he was building now would be used by mothers who walked to them instead of drove, Moses was simply too busy to see it. At Embry's drawings, Moses at least had time to glance. For more and more small park projects, even a glance could not be spared. Moses found himself forced to delegate all authority for them to subordinates. Authority is delegatable. Genius is not. Some of the men to whom the work was delegated were first-rank architects or engineers, many of them, in fact, for the Depression had driven into the arsenal many brilliant young professionals who in ordinary times would have been making names for themselves in private commissions. But they were not Robert Moses. The further Moses' presence receded from individual small park projects, the less distinguished these projects emerged. In designing the Central Park Zoo, the 79th Street Boat Basin, Jacob Riis Park, Orchard Beach, the 10 big neighborhood swimming pools, problems were solved with ingenuity and thoughtfulness. Perhaps if he had been able to take the same interest in all park problems, the problems involved, say, in the location and design of a neighborhood playground, all park problems would have been solved with ingenuity and thoughtfulness. But Moses was not taking the same interest in all park problems. And in fact, as the number of park projects multiplied, spread by the hundreds across the face of the great city, he was able to take a substantial interest in only a very small percentage of them, in, for example, only a handful of the hundreds of neighborhood playgrounds. The inevitable result was made more striking by the need for haste. Building hundreds of playgrounds as fast as possible is easier if a single basic design is used, and by the need for design approval by the WPA, an Army engineer-staffed agency in which simple designs and cheap materials, rather than architectural excellence, were the order of the day. Moses had to fight for every amenity, no matter how small. Every improvement on the basic blocky comfort station design represented a victory, hard won, because two-story structures required more expensive structural steel than one story. Moses had to plead with the WPA for weeks for approval of Imar Embry's masterful, classic, colonnaded interpretation of his insistence that the Orchard Beach bathhouse blend in with the hilly, wooded landscape behind it. And when the structure was almost finished, at a cost of $1 million, the WPA flatly refused to spend $2,500 more for two clocks that Embry had envisioned as grace notes on its towers. Moses obtained that money only by begging LaGuardia for it. There was to be no Barbizon brick and Ohio sandstone in New York City parks. Concrete, plain, unadorned concrete, and brick, plain red brick, the cheapest made, were what the WPA had in mind. Moses was able to relieve the blankness of the concrete Orchard Beach bathhouse only by finding a mysterious source of terracotta tiles, which, while cheap, at least added some necessary color, a chaste blue, to the unrelieved grayness. While Moses was willing to fight, endlessly and ingeniously, to make his big projects as perfect as possible, it was obviously unfeasible to battle over the details of every playground when one was building hundreds, especially since arguing about every design would have cost him his great advantage over other city departments with the WPA, the fact that when new funds became available, his plans were ready to go. A standard park department playground design was evolved, and architects were given little leeway to deviate from it. If there was to be an indoor playhouse in the playground, there was a standard design for that too, and if the architect wanted to make variations in it, they had better be small ones. These designs were banal, containing for the most part nothing but benches for mothers and standard active play equipment, swings, seesaws, jungle gyms, wading pools, slides, for children. The equipment was surrounded by fences that only a mother could love, either dreary chain link or high black bars that made the playgrounds look like animal cages. And they were set in a surface that even a mother had to hate, a surface cheap to lay down and easy to maintain. That was why Moses' engineers had selected it, but hard on the knees and elbows of little boys and girls who fell on it. Comfort stations, squat and unadorned, looked like nothing so much as concrete or brick pillboxes. A neighborhood committee might request some particularly desired facility, a bocce court, for example, for an Italian neighborhood, but few substitutions were permitted. Then there was the difference in usage accorded parks in the city, a difference complicated by vandalism. Designing for hard usage was not always compatible with designing for beauty, as was demonstrated by the evolution of the marginal playgrounds in Central Park. At first, the playgrounds were equipped, in addition to the swings, slides, and jungle gyms, with sandboxes, tunnel segments that children loved to crawl through, and with striped, turreted little toy guardhouses that served as play booths, and their peripheries were only a ring of benches backed by trees and shrubs that provided shade for mothers and that screened the noise of playing children from the apartment houses across the street. Dogs wandered into the playgrounds and urinated and defecated in the sandboxes, and the sandboxes had to be removed. Drunks crept into the tunnel segments at night and fell asleep, to be discovered by children the next morning sleeping in their own vomit. The tunnel segments had to be removed. Drunks wandered into the striped guardhouse play booths during the day and urinated in them. Perverts used them as hiding places from which they could watch the playing little girls and boys at close range and masturbate. Vandals pried loose the light lumber out of which the play booths were constructed. The play booths had to be removed. Then the drunks slept and the perverts hid in the trees and shrubbery behind the benches, so this landscaping had to be removed. Still, drunks kept wandering into the playgrounds at night. Moses tried to keep them out first by putting up bars between the bench groupings and little gates at the playground entrance as a warning to stay out, but the drunks ignored the warning. And finally, Moses felt he had no choice but to surround the playgrounds, now reduced to amenity-bare patches of asphalt, with high fences whose high gates could be locked at night. Critics might rage that the playgrounds now resembled animal cages. Moses saw that resemblance himself.